Yeah, it is. There's people care.
Calling in. Today is Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016. Good afternoon. Welcome, and let the record show that the House Resources Committee was convened at 1:04, is it? 1:02 p.m. We have present Representative Craig Johnson, Representative Paul Seaton, Representative Andy Josephson, Representative Mike Harker, Vice Chair, my fellow co-chair, Representative David Tallarico, and myself, Representative Benjamin Noyak. Benny, you can call me. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Hello to Julie from House Records. Hello to Matt from LIO, and we have Julie from Representative Tallarico's office, and my staff there, Gary, behind me. Hello. Today we will hear the Governor's Bill, House Bill 247, Tax Credits, Interest, Refunds, Oil, and Gas. Welcome to the presenters, and thank you for being here today. Please come forward, identify yourselves, and let the games begin. Oh, shoot, I'm still at that movie. After the House... Oh, never mind. Welcome. Commissioner?
Thank you, Chairman Nagyak. Members of the committee, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. With me is Ken Alper, the Director of Tax in the Department of Revenue. Director Alper will carry the bulk of the presentation, but I just wanted...
For the record, Representative Tarr is present.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to spend a little time kind of introducing the bill and putting in kind of the broader fiscal plan that the governor has proposed this year, and just do a little recap of kind of what happened after the end of last session through the summer to get us to this point in time. Then I'll turn it over to Director Alper to talk about the bill itself. The governor's new Sustainable Alaska plan has three major components to it. One is the use of our existing wealth, the primary earnings from the permanent fund, but earnings from other investments as well. The component for reduced spending, and a component for increased revenues, some of them being, majority of them being increase in rates to existing taxes, but also the plan is a personal income tax as well. So there's really the three components: earnings, reductions in spendings, increases in revenues. This particular bill actually hits in two places. It reduces the size of the credits that we pay out, so it's actually a cut in expenditures of about $400 million. And then it has a component that actually raises the minimum tax on producing properties from 4% to 5%. That, as well as hardening the floor, results in about $100 million in new revenue. So this one actually hits in two of the three components as you're looking through the bill. Just to kind of walk you through from the end of when the budget was signed last year to today, if you recall that the governor line item vetoed a portion of the budget, actually limited the amount of credits that we could pay in FY16 to $500 million instead of the more open-ended language that was in the original budget. That had a bit of a ripple effect through the state mildly through the oil and gas industry, particularly as it related to the smaller companies that were exploring and developing fields. Essentially, the folks that had loaned money against the credits refused to loan. They said, you know, that we're not certain these credits are going to be paid now, and they pulled back and created a real liquidity crisis within these smaller developers. So we spent the first part, first few months, kind of putting that package back together, assuring those that were loaning the money that, in fact, the state would pay the credits, that there may be some timing changes, but the credits would still all be paid. And we were able to kind of put that back together again. But it also then set off a whole series of meetings with the industry, representatives and with folks in the financial community to try and kind of get their feel for what would be a package that would work going forward. Because it was the opinion of the administration, and I think very valid opinion, that we just couldn't afford the level of credits that we were paying. And that was not a critique on whether it was a good idea to have credits in the first place, but just simply that the size of the credit program didn't match our ability to pay the credits anymore. And so we worked diligently with these companies and with the financial community and came up with a plan that we thought would resolve the majority of the issues. Senator Giesel also held a series of workshops throughout the summer. We testified at three of them, and they came up with a plan that, I think Director Alper will give kind of our idea of what a comparison between the plans is within his presentation, but I think fairly similar results, although I think we still feel a little bit more urgency in the timing of what we need to do and when. But I think it was a collaborative effort. We tried to address as many issues as we possibly could. There's still going to be areas where I think certain companies have a different idea of what the best solution is, and I'm sure that they will be more than happy to express that. But I do appreciate the openness that the companies had in meeting with us and really kind of walking us through where the significant pinch points were in this issue. And so it was good government, I think. You know, the solution still has a lot. You'll have to work through. But I think it was very participatory, and I really appreciate the fact that it was kind of a open book kind of discussions. It wasn't people just posturing for positions. So we appreciate that. And with that, I will turn it over to Director Alper.
Representative Hopper.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you don't mind me, I'm in the line of introductory comments. I'd love to have just a couple quick questions also on that, the $200 million veto last year. since it's really the introduction to this whole, where this all began, it began with a $200 million veto. And am I correct that the governor has made absolute assurance to industry that those credits that were vetoed will be honored?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, that is correct.
And
For the record, Representative Heron is here.
Thanks.
And if I could follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you. Have I missed something then? Because I haven't seen an appropriation request in the budgets that were submitted by the governor, or today we had yesterday was the deadline to introduce the supplemental appropriation for FY16. I have not seen a request for that funding. Can you explain to me what's going on there?
Sure. Let me put myself on the record for the Ken Alper, the director of the tax division at the Department of Revenue, through the chair, Representative Hawker. This bill contains a fiscal note that includes an appropriation to the oil and gas tax credit fund in the amount of $926 million and change. That supplements the $73 million and change that's in the governor's operating budget for FY17 to make the $1 billion, what we're calling transition appropriation, to kind of carry the existing program, including any overhanging credits through to the effective date of the proposed legislation.
Which fiscal note might that be?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, we wrote two fiscal notes. One of them, tax division, which talks about the implementation of the bill, and then the other one is called fund caps in its title someplace. It shows a relatively large upfront cost, and that's the one that incorporates the reductions in expenditures in the out years. It should be dated February 1st.
The fiscal notes that I have taken off the internet apparently have been superseded. So,
through the chair, Representative Hawker, I noticed on basis this morning when I was looking over this bill that the documents in question are in the document area of this legislation, but not in the fiscal notes section. You know, the various buttons under the basis organization system.
Mr. Chair, I might fail, and that's not a fiscal note then. We have a new fiscal note.
Hey, Tom, will you go ahead?
That's, you can go ahead, Mr. Chair. Thank you. When I say when I was taking it off the web, it was not there, but it was not apparently under documents, not under fiscal notes.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Hawker, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you. I believe I put myself on the record. The bill title, and I apologize for that, and I promise not to read it. I feel for the House clerk who had to read it. It's a 273-word long title. There's a lot of different pieces of statute touched upon in this bill, but it does a lot of things within the broader tax credit universe. I was hoping with slide number 3 to informally at least refer to this as an act reforming oil and gas tax credits and strengthening the minimum oil and gas production tax. And obviously, later in my presentation, I'll get much greater into detail of the specific changes in the bill. Commissioner Hoffbeck mentioned some of the history that I'm looking at on slide number 4. The governor's line item veto capped the spending at $500 million. To be clear, we have not yet spent that $500 million. The total credits claimed and refunded to date in fiscal year 16 is about $475 million. We have a number of them in process. So there isn't going to be that much actual delay in the actual buying back of tax credits before we get to what happens in the current budget cycle. The commissioner talked about the liquidity crisis. Hopefully that was resolved and will continue to stay resolved. The three presentations that we made to this Senator Geisel's working group, as well as a presentation that many of you were at in Kenai in June, are all on basis. I do recommend you reviewing them. I'm happy to review a lot of that material. You know, and I apologize that there's going to be something of an information gap possibly among this committee, because some of you might have that background and others might not. There's a lot of detail. It's a complicated topic, and please feel free to stop me at any time, and I'll go into greater detail on any specific issue. The legislation before you has been developed gradually over the last 6 or 7 months.
Well, a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Last year, when we were considering the $700 million amount on, you know, estimate, there was discussion of statutory requirement that I think it was 10% of production tax be paid, which was about $91 million. And the governor obviously arrived at $500 million for other considerations. If we were looking at that statutory construction that was considered then, yielding $91 million in the last fiscal years, what's that anticipated to be for this coming fiscal year?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the formula, which is in 4355028C, is tied to the price of oil. It would be 15% of production taxes before the application of any credits. If the price of oil is expected to be below 60, which it is, and the answer is $73.4 million. That comports with what the governor put in the operating budget for fiscal year 17.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Thank you. Just a little bit of background. I promise not to dwell on the history unless there's a lot of questions. The world of oil and gas tax credits, the modern world anyway, began in 2003. With the alternative credit for exploration. This was a percentage of qualified expenditures, and it could be taken against what was then a gross-based tax, the known as the ELF, or economic limit factor. The bulk of the credit system was put in place in 2006 with the PPT bill, the petroleum production tax. That was the switch to the net profits tax. That's where we started to see credits for operating losses, credits for capital expenditures, and that sort of thing. That bill also included the Cook Inlet tax caps, the maximum taxes that Cook Inlet producers currently enjoy. It also added the possibility of the state repurchasing credits. Prior to that, the credits had to be held and used against the tax liability. The PPT system was modified and expanded upon with the passage of Alaska's Clear and Equitable Share, the so-called ACES bill, in a fall special session in 2007. The most interesting point in there, credit-wise, was that the repurchase provision was made open-ended. There were no more caps on it, and it set up a specific fund to which the legislature appropriates money every year and from which the Department of Revenue repurchases tax credits. Many of the credits were expanded upon or added with the Cook Inlet Recovery Act. That was Representative Hawker's bill in 2010, House Bill 280, and some companion legislation in the other body. That added, among other things, the 40% well lease expenditure credit and a bunch of other more subtle and technical treatment issues as to how credits were calculated. to encourage additional exploration and development in Cook Inlet, and has led certainly to a lot of activity and in many ways the pushing back of the concerns about supply anxiety that were driving the conversation at that moment in history. In 2012, the legislature passed the Frontier Basin Bill. That added a lot of new benefits, new credits in the previously undeveloped areas of the state in the interior and other parts, in some ways modeled after the Cook Inlet Recovery Act. Finally, when Senate Bill 21, which was primarily an oil tax overhaul in 2013 on the North Slope, it eliminated the so-called spending credits, the 20% capital credit, and replaced it with the what we now know as the per taxable barrel credit, the sliding scale credit tied to production.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Hopper.
With apologies, but now that I'm actually in possession of the fiscal note, may I ask a question on that? I've had a chance to read it.
Go ahead.
Thank you. My point being, one of the things I am concerned about is living up to our promise to producers that we owe, the state of Alaska owes $200 million to. And I think that's kind of an unconditional obligation at this point. I'll certainly, we could go back and retroactively repeal that if we chose to, and I'm wondering if that really is your intention, because I'd like to quote from the fiscal note here that your appropriation that you said contained that money is contingent upon passage of a version of this bill. So is that a hostage provision? You will not pay those producer tax credits if we do not pass a version of this bill for you?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker. No, with those are liabilities of the state that will be honored. It's quite simply, if this particular package doesn't pass, then we will need some modification in order to have the appropriation to pay the credits. But those credits are a liability of the state, and they will be honored.
I really appreciate that clarity, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And thank you, Commissioner Hoffbeck. Very much appreciate that.
And if I may, through the chair, Representative Hawker, for the benefit of all folks watching, most of you know this, the tax credit is really a two-step process. When a company does the desired activity, submits the application, they earn a thing called a credit certificate. That is a paper asset, and that is subject to the statute and does not change regardless of what's in any budget. The repurchasing of those certificates is the fact that's limited by the appropriation. So what ends up happening, should nothing happen other than last year's veto, there'll be about $200 million of outstanding certificates that are owned by companies and had not yet been purchased by the state. And what we're looking at is providing the means to repurchase those certificates. Continuing with the history of the theory of tax credits, why did we do this? Really to encourage or incentivize a desired behavior. We wanted companies to come in and make investments that they weren't otherwise making. There was anxiety about declining production, desire to diversify the oil field, in Cook Inlet to create some supply certainty. Later on, the credits were built into the net profits tax system. What does that really mean? We anticipate a certain minimum amount of credits just because we know that a certain amount of money, say, is going to be spent or a certain number of oil is produced. So we established a relatively high tax rate that was offset by a robust credit system, and that all got built into an expected revenue. At times, though, as credits got added over time, they were layered with each other. We started getting the same behavior, receiving multiple credits in some unanticipated circumstances, some very high levels of state support at times. As I said earlier, credits can either be used against tax liability, meaning subtracted from a company's tax bill if they owe taxes. If not, they could be cashed out, repurchased by the state, subject to appropriation. There's a specific provision in current law that says basically the large producers, if you produce more than 50,000 barrels a day, you're not eligible to get cash for your credits, to have your credits repurchased. In those cases, should that company not have a tax liability, they would have to carry their credits forward into a future tax year and then use them against their taxes.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ken, I may have missed it, so if you can indulge me, is the original what the legislature is, the $700 million credit balance, and then it was reduced by the governor. How much is left in that? What's the balance currently?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, the amount in the tax credit fund is $25 or $28 million right now. The $500 million was transferred into it early in the fiscal year. We've repurchased, last time I checked, $472 million. That number might not be precise. leaving around $28 million left in the fund for the rest of fiscal year 16.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, to continue that point through the chair, Representative Herron, there's an inherent front-loadedness in the fiscal year for tax credit repurchases, and the reason for that is most of our applications come with our tax filings. The major oil producers pay their taxes, or even the smaller oil companies. The due date for the production tax is the end of March for the previous calendar year, and then we have a statutory obligation to issue certificates in 120 days. So for the most part, we give our credit certificates in July, and then they get turned around, and many of them right away the next day are requesting repurchase, and then there's sometimes several weeks of just getting the bank accounts worked out and all that and transferring the money. But by the end of August into September, usually two-thirds of the year's credit money has already been spent. So it's very front-loaded in the fiscal year.
Mr. Chairman, just I appreciate that information, but this is a more overarching question on the whole bill itself and the credits. Given the current situation with the price of oil, et cetera, the tax credit situation now be self-correcting? Why do we need this legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, for the record, Randy Hoffman, Commissioner of Revenue. We're seeing a transition within the credit package. When the oil prices are low, the capital is constrained, we see less actual work being done that can be claimed for credits, but we see more losses in companies. And so we start seeing a growth in the net operating loss credit. So we would kind of hope that it was self-correct, but it didn't. It essentially, the credits have moved more towards the net operating loss side of the ledger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's an interesting step on NOSs, and I'll save it for a later. And thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So slide 7 is the major credits on the books right now, and we really want to focus on the top three of them. The bottom two are at least partially sunsetting in the near future. The net operating loss credit, the commissioner just mentioned, we pay companies back for a percentage of their losses. It varies by time period and area of the state. That credit is notably stackable, meaning you can earn that credit as well as one of the other credits, and that's where some of these very large rates of state participation has come in. The per taxable barrel credit, that's the North Slope production credit added by Senate Bill 21. It ranges between $0 and $8 for what we call legacy oil. It's a flat $5 for new oil, and it can only be used against tax liability. This is one of the so-called use it or lose it credits. The capital or well lease expenditure credit, the 20% and 40% credit, do not exist in the North Slope. They're only in the other areas of the state. Those are credits based on company expenditures, qualified expenditures, and are generally refunded and can be once again stacked with the operating loss credit. The exploration credit can be used in place of the capital credit if a company qualifies. They're a little bit larger. They have a little bit different rules. They have data submission requirements with the Department of Natural Resources. Most of those are expiring this July, although they have been extended. Certain of them have in the interior areas, in the what they call the frontier or Middle Earth areas.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you again, Mr. Chair. I really want to question your characterization of the 024 INJ as a credit. I think you're well aware that element, it really operates as a component of establishing the base tax rate, and the result of that element is it's not a credit you take against the payment of a tax. It is used in it is part of the calculus of developing the tax rate at which one pays, and in fact that item was put into the legislation specifically to create a progressive effective tax rate. So I'm just kind of curious why you're characterizing it as a credit along with these other elements, which have a completely different economic operation.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, we agree wholeheartedly with your characterization of the per barrel credit. It is very much a component of the tax system. I would go so far as to say, had that not existed, likely the legislature would have come around to a lower tax rate. And I'll say the same thing about the 20% capital credit in the ACES era, which was primarily a major offset. that lowered the tax rate and was built in. For accounting purposes, for reporting purposes, we consider it a credit. It's described in statute as a credit. But in all of our reporting, we refer to it clearly as a credit used against liability, which has a different character and a different, really a different series of policy decisions that we're looking at, as opposed to those credits that are refunded by the state.
So, again, Mr. Chair, that didn't answer my question. Why are you characterizing it in this document and in this public report and before this legislature as a credit, comparable, the same economic character as the others? Why are you doing that?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, we're listing comprehensively in this slide all of the different credits. As we get deeper into the proposal and the bill itself, you will see that we're not intending to do anything to that credit. We're aware of it. It is called a credit in statute, and we are trying to comprehensively describe all of the credits that are in statute.
If I recall, it is really characterized as a gross value reduction.
Through the chair, we can look at the statutes later on and define it at the appropriate time.
It's a credit. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but it's a really important part here that when we look at this, we have to understand that that operates so completely different than every one of these other true credits that we're considering that it's critical that we understand that difference. So any point made, thank you.
And if I may, through the chair, Representative Hawker, that credit in a very low price environment is unusual in that it is truly a use it or lose it credit. Or use a deduction, whatever we choose to call it. In fiscal year 16, where prices are expected to be very low for the entirety of the year, only $28 million worth of that credit are going to be used. Basically, that's the amount of subtraction the companies can take before they bump up against the minimum tax, and then they lose the rest of it. In a year with higher oil prices, we could see over $1 billion in that offset. Mm-hmm. But that credit, that offset tends to decrease to zero in a low-price environment. It is not a major component of the credit cost to the state in this low-price era. The next item on the list, I mentioned the capital and well credit outside the North Slope. The other two, the exploration credits, are sunsetting in the interior. And the final line item, the small producer credit, was a component of the PPT bill. It's up to $12 million off of your taxes if you meet certain small production criteria. We are no longer accepting applicants per statute after May of this year. However, it's what we call a slow sunset. Once you're inside the small producer credit regime, you could receive it for up to 9 years. Consequently, we'll be paying at least some or small producer credits until about 2024. And this is getting to what Representative Hawker said before. Through 2015, depending on what you count, $7.4 billion have been spent on credits or taken in credits against liability. However, of that number, $4.3 billion were credits against liability on the North Slope, which for the most part are offsets to the tax regime, either the per taxable barrel credit in SB 21 or the 20% capital credit in ACES. And we do characterize those very differently than the other roughly $3 billion worth of refunded credits. On the North Slope, there were $2.1 billion in refunded credits. These were from the new producers, the explorers that were developing new fields. Outside the North Slope, there was about $1 billion in credits. Of that, only about $100 million was used against liability. That's largely because there isn't very much tax liability in Cook Inlet because of the tax caps that were put in place in the PPT bill. We've attempted to calculate that through the end of 2013. Somewhere between $500 and $800 million is the value of those tax caps, the tax reductions in statute. In addition, there have been $900 million in refunded credits through the end of FY15, and the great bulk of that has been in the last 3 or 4 years since the Cook Inlet credit regime was opened up, and there's a lot more activity drawn into the inlet.
Representative Walker.
And thank you again, Mr. Chair. It's a headline slide. 2007 through 2015, certainly, legislation passed by this legislature has resulted in, $7.4 billion in what we call tax credits here. During that same 2007 to 2015, how much did the state collect from the oil and gas industry?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I know that the production tax number, I think that might be a year old, through 2014, I have the number $27 billion in my head. To that, we'd have to add the corporate income tax, the royalty, probably a number in the neighborhood of $40 billion.
Thank you very kindly.
Proceed.
slide number 9 shows the regional breakdown of the specifically the refunded tax credits, the approximately $3 billion in historic refunded credits between the North Slope and the non-North Slope area. Let me just as a sidebar at this moment, because the Middle Earth or the interior areas of the state are so few, tax credits have been claimed. We're not able to discuss them without violating taxpayer confidentiality. What we've done is merge them, commingle them with the Cook Inlet and call it non-North Slope. But when you see that figure, it's almost entirely Cook Inlet with a small amount of the interior exploration work that's been ongoing. And you could see a increase in the relative share of Cook Inlet credits with it now being greater than 50% over the last couple of years.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have established a system to stimulate, and it's been successful in stimulating exploration and all. I am concerned that on what the net present value is to those, to the state, and whether over the lifespan of the fields we project that we are going to be having to institute an income tax or a sales tax or something to generate revenue to pay more, because we will have a net present value loss from some of these very big tax credits that we've given. So I don't see it here, but at some point in time when we're talking about tax credits and the value of those tax credits, I want to see that in relationship to the net present value to the state of the entire existence, the 30-year life of a field. And when we invest the money and when we get the payback, and whether in the end of a 30-year lifespan, depending on different prices, whether we actually are having to essentially in the future tax citizens individually to pay for some of these investments that we are encouraging. So, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure that we look at this holistically, and so that we look at that eventually in this discussion. So thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we over the last several years, we've been seeing more what we call field life cycle modeling. I first saw it from the consultants that LB&A had from PFC, I believe they were called. They're now Analytica. Professor Goldsmith did some life cycle modeling and some of his analysis, and we've been trying to replicate that in the tax division. We would like very much to bring some sort of field examples as to, you know, and some of it we discussed before this committee when we talked about the ANWR potential developments last spring. There's a lot of credit cost in the upfront part, and then the revenue comes later, and then it's important to have a conversation about the time value of money, and do we actually see our money back at the back end when we're spending a lot of money in the upfront. It's an important conversation, and we look forward to talking about it more later on in the session. Setting aside the large credits used against liability that were a core component of the tax system, the state has paid and refunded about $3 billion in credits through the end of FY15. And when you look at that number, so much of the line item specific information is confidential. We can't talk about specific products. We've tried our best to slice and dice it and put it in a format where we can discuss order of magnitude. What are we talking about here? Of that $3 billion, a little less than $1.5 billion went to 6 North Slope projects that are currently in production, fields that were in development and are now producing. About $650 million, or about a third of it, went to 13 other projects, some of which we expect to be produced, some of which were exploration or pre-development projects that never came to fruition. On the non-North Slope or Cook Inlet Plus area, it's been about 50-50. There are 6 projects that are in production that received about $450 million in credits, and 8 other projects that do not yet have any production, although we do expect the bulk of those will eventually produce oil or gas for the state.
Representative Harper.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. This slide begs 2 questions from me. And one is, if you add the 2 numbers, 650, 450, we've given, under our current statutes, a little over $1 billion to companies that have had no production, no contribution to the state, apparently. You think that was a good idea?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I don't know that I want to answer a flat yes or no to that question. It was part of a larger policy direction. We're paying companies essentially on activity, and without necessarily a guarantee. The bulk of the money is turning into production. I think this analysis might unfortunately be easier to do in a few years when we see what really does lead to production, and then we could do some analysis. For example, how many dollars per barrel of increased production have we spent? And we've struggled with trying to do that analysis and have not been able to come up with any meaningful results to say how much are we really spending and how much new activity has it led to. It's a big question mark. It's hard to know exactly what would have happened if these credits didn't exist.
Yeah. Quick follow-up on that one. You know, these credits resulted from a policy call in the legislature, a contentious policy call, actually, from folks that said that the state of Alaska really needed to provide substantial funding and put all the smaller producers. The state needed to step up and put those producers on, or not producers, those explorers on equal footing with the larger companies that were having, you know, significant production. You know, that was an argument made on the floor, has been made in this committee. You know, some of us agreed with it, some of us didn't. But I'm again wondering if we are really starting to question whether the state ought be supporting non-producing entities or whether we should only be supporting producing entities. And I'd like to add into that question, because you'd answer me in the context of the bill that you also indicate in your fiscal note is, you know, all contingent and wrapped up into this, and that's the new ADA bill that says we are going to eliminate all these credits. A big part of getting rid of all these credits is replacing them with a loan system that only producing companies with proven reserves, the ability to produce, will be receiving. So it seems that the administration has made a policy call that we're not going to support non-producers. We will only be supporting those that have already proven up their reserves in the future. Is that our policy direction?
Through the chair, Representative Hocker. No, it isn't. I mean, because we left the net operating loss credit in place, we are still supporting exploration activities and pre-development activities. That not at the level that we have in the past, but we would still be supporting at a 25% or 35% level, depending whether you're in Cook Inlet or on the North Slope.
So basically, we're adjusting our levels here.
Correct. And to follow up on that, that net operating loss credit is one of the more difficult ones for us to control as far as what the value of that credit is. But it's one that became very clear in our discussions with the companies over the summer that was the critical credit in the picnic basket of credits.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Alper, through the chair, I assume that part of the reason it's hard to gauge the efficacy of the credits now is because there are all these variables like happenstance, finding more oil or gas than you thought might be or one thought might be, or price and out of our control. So there are a number of factors that are difficult to fit into any calculus. Is that a fair statement?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, absolutely. We simply can't know what would have happened in the negative if we weren't doing these things. And frankly, some of the larger projects that are currently in production on the North Slope were in the pre-development or development process prior to the passage of the PPT bill in 2006, yet were, by the nature of their projects, eligible for a certain amount of credits. So it's hard to say what maintained them, what stopped them from being stopped, what encouraged them to develop more. It's a very, very difficult analysis to do. And if I could say one more word on operating loss credits, you know, to follow what Commissioner Hoffbeck said, the operating loss credit is in many ways, especially on the North Slope, a playing field leveler. It's a net profits tax, which means if you're an incumbent producer, if you have a tax liability, and you spend one more dollar, you've reduced your taxable net profits by that dollar, and you're saving 35 cents on your taxes. The net operating loss credit creates a mechanism for the state to let a newcomer, a new producer, someone exploring or developing a field that doesn't yet have any income, to get that same 35-cent benefit without having a tax liability. So in some ways, it's about equity. It's about making our resources available to not just the major incumbent producers, but to the newcomers that are trying to enter the oil field.
How about Jim Heron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this point here, so does this proposed legislation, we want to gain more explorers, but why is this proposed bill actually explain to me why is it not actually discouraging explorers? We might get less explorers.
The chair, Representative Herron, we're not encouraging or discouraging explorers. The exploration credits are scheduled to sunset this summer. We're simply not addressing that. We're allowing that to happen. But the exploration credit numbers predate the passage of SB 21, and it actually created unusual circumstances where the state has been paying up to 45% of certain costs on the North Slope. That's, in many ways, an unsustainable number. With those credits going away, the North Slope exploration credit support would be through the operating loss credit at the 35% level.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just thinking about the credits that you're referring to, so say something like the Mustang development would be in the $1.45 billion category there of a project that has come online. but then we know there were other companies that went out of business. So, I mean, would we have an opportunity to evaluate sort of a tipping point, if you will, for that? I mean, is there a company that's too small or too under-resourced that we've learned now is not likely to have success, that maybe we would want to be more specific on the net operating loss credits? Or do you think it's, you know, as broadly applied, working in the way that it should?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, one of the things we contemplated as we developed this legislation was some sort of a pre-approval or a filter process. Industry didn't like it very much. We were uncomfortable with it ourselves. We don't necessarily want to be picking winners and losers. In the absence of that, and it ended up not surviving to the final version of this legislation. In the absence of that, it's very hard. These are laws of general applicability. If you do the desired activity, you earn the thing. Regarding your point on Mustang, I can't comment obviously on a specific company, but what we are trying to do with the changes proposed in this bill, to a certain extent, is help control who's getting cash versus what companies we feel are more able to hold on to their credit certificates until that future point where they might have a tax liability they could use them against.
Thank you.
To the chair, if I could just add on to the question as well. The fact that we're actually removing some of these credits that can be stacked, mm-hmm. which could actually result in sometimes 75-80% of the cost being borne by the state, is now going to be 25 or 35%. I think that will self-correct some of those issues as well, because if somebody has 75% of their own money in the game, I think they're probably less likely, they're more likely to be better capitalized before they come in. So
thank you,
Representative Harper.
And thank you. We've kind of gone two questions here, but what you and Ken, you brought up a really important distinction: the pre and post SB 21 tax regimes. The pre SB 21 tax regime had the very generous QCEs, the qualified capital expenditure credits. That went away in 2013, and you know, your cumulative numbers here, where you're showing big numbers, they don't distinguish between pre-SB 21 and post-SB 21. And I think, you know, there might be some, I don't know that it is appropriate for us to be making a judgment call or pass judgment on our tax regime system when we're looking at a blended set of numbers here. I don't know that you can accurately, truly say whether or not, how the current system's working based on a blend of two very different tax systems. So something you might want to think about as you, present this bill, finding ways to distinguish those for us and start, let's talk about our current regime and let's not blend it with an old regime that we have substantially modified and already made substantial reductions in credits.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, thank you. And yes, we would like to try to parse that out by time period, and we've tried in some preliminary documents. I would like to make one clarification, though. During the ACES era, prior to the passage of SB 21, the state's general level of support for North Slope activity was at around 45%. That was the then 25% operating loss credit stacked with a 20% qualified capital expenditure, the QCE credit. With the passage of SB 21, the number was reduced from 45% to 35%, which is the new increased operating loss credit with the elimination of the QCE. However, there's an asterisk on that, and the asterisk is there was a temporary measure where the operating loss credit was bumped to 45% for calendar years 2014 and 15, the first 2 years after the implementation of the effective date of 21. So really, the state's level of support for North Slope activities has remained constant through the ACES era and to today, and it's only beginning in January of 2016 where you're going to see a drop-off in those relative numbers.
And you have just made my point.
I'm Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm somewhat troubled by the idea of the net operating loss being considered as being equity between non-producers and producers when the net operating loss used to be 25% based on the base rate, and then we introduced a 35% base rate with a gross dollar per barrel reduction. But when you go to net operating loss, that doesn't count, so everything gets, expenditures get offset at 35%. So now we have a 35%, and I guess my concern is that when we first did PPT and ACES and Pedro Van Meers was helping us design this and everything, the statement was generally very adamant that we didn't want to have over 20% tax credit because our liability would be huge if we were in a downturn like we are now, and we are committing to huge amounts of tax credits based on investment, totally unrelated to our income. And so now we find ourselves in exactly that situation of having large amounts of credits that are based on investment, supporting big international oil companies that are to over a third of their expenditures, and having very little revenue. And so I'm trying to figure out how we are even, other than just testimony from industry saying they like 35% of their expenses being written off or carried forward at state expense, how are we justifying 35% net operating loss credit?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this bill, and it's the wish of Governor Walker to not address sort of the core components of the underlying tax system, the tax rate, the operating loss, the gross value reduction, for example. You do raise an interesting point. If you go back to the PPT and ACES era where the operating loss credit was tied to the base tax rate, but yet the base tax rate often increased because of the additive feature of progressivity. So in effect, the state's support for the non-producers was tended to be less than or equal to the support for the majors, because now the per barrel credit is a subtractive feature. Really, we're providing a higher level of support for the non-producers and the newcomers than we are for the major base producers. That's a correct observation. Thank you for raising it.
Proceed.
So this next slide talks about this year's money. A question was asked earlier in this presentation of the $500 million that was authorized. About $472 has been paid. Of that, about $200 was for the North Slope and $272 from the Cook Inlet area. That's a little less than 60% non-North Slope, which comports with the 2015 data. So we've got a trend now. The numbers that have gone out the door are almost entirely 2014 operating loss credits, and also the when I say Cook Inlet drilling, that means the qualified capital and the well lease expenditure credits. In some cases, the companies apply for those quarterly rather than waiting to the end of the year, but the 2014 credits are all out the door. We still expect there to be $700 million in total demand, with the rest of it being sort of partial 2015 credits and other things that don't need to be officially spent on or authorized until next July, until 120 days after the next tax payment year. If I can switch gears for a moment, having gone through a little bit of history of credits, I want to talk about the history of the floor or the minimum tax in Alaskan production tax statutes. During the gross era, there was what was called a cents per barrel tax. In 2005, which was the last full year of ELF, it was 60 to 80 cents with an adjustment tied to the specific gravity, the API measurement. The more valuable oil was taxed at the higher level, essentially. With the PPT bill, the legislature introduced a gross minimum tax as a potential security blanket against the net profits tax. It was 4% of the gross value with a sliding scale down tied to the price of oil. That's an annual average price of oil. And if the price is over $25, which even in today's grave times, we're still above $25, it's a 4% gross tax. However, under the PPT and ACES era, that floor could be penetrated, pierced by many of the credits, including the 20% QCE capital credit So, you know, and I've said it in many committees, if ACES was the law today, we would be receiving zero rather than some version of the minimum tax that we're getting today. Under SB 21, by specifically saying that the per taxable barrel credit can't reduce the tax liability below the floor, the floor was strengthened for legacy oil, specifically for the older oil fields. They are paying at the floor level. However, several other credits could reduce payments below that. That's the net operating loss credit, small producer credit, various exploration credits, as well as the per barrel credit for so-called new oil, for oil eligible for the GVR. That $5 a barrel credit could reduce payments all the way to zero. As much talk and law as there ever was about the minimum tax, it was really never broadly triggered. It was never used until late in 2014, where we started seeing a monthly payment estimates coming in at the floor level. And then throughout 2015, nearly all of our production tax receipts have been based on the minimum tax on the 4% gross. So as we get to the bill itself, there's sort of broader themes that the commissioner talked about that I'll just reiterate here. We need to reduce the state's annual cash outlay. That's just a sheer necessity. We don't have the money. We don't have the budget to be able to support $500 million in spending. You know, when we talk about a $5 billion GF, $500 million in tax credits is 10%. And as we look to broadly cut the budget and make a sustainable Alaska, we need to cut tax credits as part of a broader package. When we look to pick winners and losers here, we want to protect that net operating loss in some form because it is something of a playing field leveler. I said that a few minutes ago. Limiting repurchases, and I said that when I answered Representative Tarr's question, we are going to put some new rules as to who gets repurchased versus who might be required to hold their credits until they had a tax liability. We want to strengthen that minimum tax, make sure it can't, that we truly are getting the 4%. We want to have more transparency, more ability to talk about some specifics in public without violating taxpayer confidentiality. And, of course, we want to honor and pay what's been earned to date and through any transition period. Whatever the effective date is of the final legislation, we want to make sure that there's enough money to pay off all of those credits as we go.
Representative Ron Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Mr. Alper, the limiting of repurchases, the principal feature is this question of local hire, as I understand it. But will there also be pre-screening of the rocks in the ground and you know, the quality of the investment?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there are several specific features of the bill that I'll be getting to in a few slides that talk about that. One of them is the local hire provision. There's also an annual cap. Basically, we're not going to purchase more than $25 million per company per year. And then, possibly more importantly, there's a cap on the size of the company. If you're a large multinational company, and we put in there a language to say if you have global revenue in excess of $10 billion per year, and then we feel that that company has the balance sheet to hold their credits on their own books and then use them at some future time when their field comes into production and they could offset their taxes.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you. You know, this is a great slide summarizing your, you call it themes, but it's your intent behind the bill. hypothetically, we passed this bill verbatim as it was handed to us, no questions asked. Have you done any analysis, done any way of projecting what the consequences of this bill would be on the industry that we will be increasing substantially, you know, taxes on here? And as you said, through all of these various themes, what will be the effect on, you know, future investment, production, and ultimately on states' revenues over time? Have you got an analysis that shows what the downstream consequences of this bill will be?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, we don't have a specific analysis because it's very, once again, hard to predict. And we're touching many different sectors in many different ways with this legislation. You know, it's our expectation that most of the projects that are ongoing would continue to happen. Like the commissioner said earlier, future projects that might be a little bit marginal, if they suddenly go from getting two-thirds state money to 25% state money, a couple of things might not happen. That's true. But we feel that enough is going to continue to happen that the supply problems won't be a problem and that we will have a level of oil and gas activity that's commensurate with our ability to afford it. You know, if something requires two-thirds state money to happen, at some point, you know, is it appropriate to have the conversation about, well, maybe that shouldn't happen? know, perhaps that activity should be able to stand on its own merits a little bit more.
Representative Heron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got a segue question from Representative Hawker, and then I'll have two short questions to follow that. So, Ken, I'm not as articulate as the LBNA chair, but in asking this question, but I think in my mind, the question is what is the government's take in this proposed legislation? What will we get out of this deal?
Through the chair, Representative Heron, the expectation is that the state has got into a system of paying several hundred million dollars per year in refunded tax credits. No one really contemplated that until fairly recently because the state was receiving $3, $4, sometimes over $6 billion a year in the production tax. The production tax revenue has now reached $100, $200 million a year, yet the credit liability is roughly the same, maybe slightly smaller, and suddenly we say, you know, something's out of balance. So the first thing we get is one step closer to a balanced budget. You know, the governor proposed $500 million in cuts in his FY17 budget. $400 million of them are in the bill that's before you today. We get perhaps a little bit more certainty that the projects that are going forward are on a sound financial footing, that are more likely to be resulting in meaningful production. We also get a little bit of protection of our minimum tax. We put in a 4% minimum tax, but I don't think there was full understanding at all levels of government as to what did and didn't penetrate that tax. And as I'll say in a couple of slides, the Senate committee recommended that we do things to ensure that we really do get 4% of the gross. Right now, because of some unusual factors, we are not actually getting a full 4% of the gross, and we're trying to bump that up and, in a second-order conversation, increase it to 5%. So guaranteeing ourselves at least a minimum level of annual revenue, even in times of shortfall in the industry.
So, Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up is, so I waited till this slide, but could you give me some insight on the administration's policy discussion that led up to the introduction? Could you share with us who participated? Who would?
Through the chair, Representative Heron. There was various people at various times. As far as the policy decision that led up to this, it was twofold. One is the fact that, quite frankly, the size of the pie that we have to support all of the things that we're spending money on was not large enough to support everything anymore, and so we had to pull back, and we're pulling back on essentially everything that's most things. This was one of the outflows quite frankly, is not a core government service. What it had to be balanced against education, life, health, safety, roads, those kind of things. And so it was considered an area where the state it was prudent for the state to pull back on in this particular area. We're not pulling all the way out, but we just simply can't afford the level of support that we're doing right now. The second component was just that. We do recognize, however, that some level of support was necessary, and so that's we tried to balance that by leaving a fairly substantial level of support still in the bill, but just that quite a bit less than it was before. And so that was a recognition we couldn't afford it, and secondly, that we needed to continue some level of support, but at a lower level.
So, but Mr. Chairman, can you name names? I asked who participated. Obviously yourself and others, but can you name names?
As far as who was in the meetings?
In this policy discussion that led up to the introduction?
Through the chair, Representative Heron, it would have been largely revenue staff, Director Alper, myself, the governor, the chief of staff. That's probably the four that had the most input into it, but that was all based on information that we received through extensive meetings with industry, the investment community, and quite frankly, the work that Senator Geisel did with her committee as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Harper.
Thank you. And follow up on there was a difference between the question that Rep. Heron asked and what the question I asked. And Rep. Heron asked, you know, what's really the consequence on the, you know, what's the state's revenue side of this? And the answer was largely, we're doing what we need to do to balance our budget, and that's what our priority in doing this is. My question was really the other side, which is, what is the consequence of making this decision? And literally, at this point in time, arguably taking another $500 million a year or more out of an industry in this state that is not making money today in this state at these prices. In fact, I had a meeting just today when one of the senior people at one of our major producers gave me the statistic and said that I could use it, that their company is losing $3 million a day continuing to operate in Alaska. And you said, quote, take it on faith that we're going to have the investment, we're going to have the continued development that we need in this state, but yet you don't, did I hear you say you guys have not had anyone work on modeling, identifying the consequences of this legislation on the individual players, and we're to take it on faith that we assess major tax increases on entities that are losing money in this state today and there's not going to be a negative consequence?
To the chair, Representative Hawker. There are 2 points. First of all, we have contracted with ICER to look at the impacts of all of the decisions we're making here, because quite frankly, there's not a single lever in this entire budget that doesn't have consequences. And so that analysis is being done. But the recognition that there just simply isn't a way to balance a $4 billion budget deficit without some collateral consequences in the economy. Secondly, I think I have to go right to the point that you made earlier about the difference between credits that are embedded in the tax system, which are part of is a tax issue, and the credits that are really in place to try and incentivize certain activities, which quite frankly, when you take away money that you're giving to somebody, it's a little different than when you're taxing somebody taking money out that you did not first provide to them in the first place. And so I do see a little bit of a distinction between this $400 million as being characterized as a tax increase. I really do see it as a credit reduction.
You know, at the end of the day, it's, and I understand what you're saying, you're talking about taking away these credits, again, particularly, you know, the people that will be most profoundly affected by that are those small companies that don't have revenue here. And again, that's the type of question I'm asking, is what will be the consequences? Will we be driving those small companies out of state? Will we make Alaska a state that is not attractive? You know, I just saw a article today. It was it's on Alaska Public Media, and this is the head of Bluecrest Energy, who said that the company probably won't develop the natural gas in Cosmopolitan if the legislature makes big changes to the state's tax credit program. That's the kind of consequences I would like to know about. And because, yes, taking away credits is going to affect one cohort of our investors in one way. The tax rate itself is going to affect those larger players, those larger producers that are, in fact, contributing all the money that we are ultimately redistributing here today. So, you know, I agree there's definitely a difference between the two, but at the end of the day, we have to look at the consequences on the relevant cohort. So we can't say, well, you take away this credit, it's not going to affect the big producers. Yeah, maybe it won't be. But likewise, we change the tax rate. Let's just say we jack up the tax rate 100% on production. That's not going to have any effect on a non-producing entity, but I think we might have to ask, would they ever be willing to go into production if we raise that rate? So I agree. It's a wonderful debate to have, and I don't have enough time to really get into it with you here in the chair. Would like to move on. Thank you, sir.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just now that we've kind of gotten on these points, I know, at least because we get reporting from one company, most recently ConocoPhillips had $393 million in profit for the third quarter in Alaska operations. So at least one company is still making some money. The second thing I wanted to ask about is in Cook Inlet, you know, and I've talked to producers about changing the credits there, and even from them, they've said, you know, the credits were intended because we had a potential gas shortage and we're really concerned looking at gas imports, that the, you know, we wanted to spur development there, but that's been largely accomplished. And I guess, you know, just looking at that experience, how can we better assess whether credits had their intended purpose, so that going forward, you know, we don't have some of these same sort of discussions, if that makes sense. But like I say, I mean, even talking to producers themselves to understand better how that might impact, at least in the circumstance of the Cook Inlet, people responded by saying, you know, they've met their intended purpose. We know it's time for change. You know, there's interest in keeping some in place, perhaps, you know, like the ones that will remain. How can we better understand when they've, you know, incentivized development in the way we wanted?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I think that's a good point. I think when the credits really grew in the 2010 era, you know, we were a market looking for gas, and there was a real need to incentivize activity. But currently in the Cook Inlet right now, we've got gas in search of a market. And so we really, that dynamic has changed. And so the question, that begs the question then, do you need that level of support at this point in time? That level of support had some impact when we needed it. Do we need to continue at that level? Or now is there a different level of credit support that allows us to have a more steady state go forward? And I think that really is the question. But I think a lot of it's going to be something that only time will tell whether, in fact, this is the right rate as well. I can tell you, though, that we've had a tremendous number of discussions with these particular players in Cook Inlet to get their impact on the credit before we propose the credit reform. So.
Thank you.
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, you mentioned an ICER report. Any time estimate on when that might be available?
Through the chair, Representative Tallarico, we were supposed to have it already. I saw Gunnar Knapp a couple of days ago, and he said that the executive summary is about complete, and that we should be seeing the report within a couple of weeks.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, oftentimes we look at individual things and credit them for the outcomes. You know, something was said about some of the production or pre-production on the North Slope that was already going forward before we changed our tax system there. And I would like to point out to everyone that we assume that the credits were what drove the financial or the exploration in Cook Inlet. But at the same time, what we had was the Regulatory Commission of Alaska changing from a position of meaning that whatever you sold at a barely break even at $2.50, $3 per MCF gas to $6 to $8 per MCF. So now people can make money on the gas they sell. It's hard to incentivize somebody with credits if what you produce, your product, isn't going to be profitable. But it doesn't mean that because you provide credits and now you have a profitable product, which of those two elements drove the investment? So, you know, I would like to make sure that everybody realize that we need to balance and look at. I mean, we have some of the highest priced gas in the nation right now. I mean, it's $7.50 or something like that, depending on the season, where that's sold in the Cook Inlet Basin. People can make money on it. Henry Hub is $2.80 or something. There's a huge difference in the profitability of the gas, and no one is giving any relationship to the profitability of the gas and saying that all the exploration was done not because you could make a profit on your product, but because the state gave you a subsidy. And I'm very concerned that as we go forward with these credits, we ought to say what they really are. They're subsidies to these companies and subsidies to the product. And it's not just credits. And so I think that we should consider that term as well as we talk about these things. And I'm very concerned about number two on this slide, that we're talking about the states looking at this as protecting the net operating loss credits as playing a field leveler between legacy producers and newcomers, and I'm very concerned that if we say, oh, we got to go to 35% of everybody's expenditures to level the playing field, even if we're losing money on all of those credits that are being paid. We need to actually look at the amount of the credit we're paying and see if it makes sense in the full term for what we're getting, not for just saying, oh, we're going to be a referee between legacy producers and new producers, and we're going to give everybody a big subsidy or a big write-off against their expenses. And so I hope that as we go through this, we also think of what's the state's liability in here as well. Thank you.
A point of clarification.
I think I heard said a minute ago that ConocoPhillips' third quarter resulted in earnings, and they were earning money in the state of Alaska.
Through the third quarter.
Pardon me?
Year-to-date.
Through the third quarter.
Third quarter, which is ending September.
No, last year.
Third quarter? You're going back a year.
The third quarter report, fourth quarter report is not out yet.
Yeah.
Correct. And ConocoPhillips reports its earnings tomorrow, not today.
For fourth quarter.
And through the chair on that point, I would expect the fourth quarter results would be weaker. The price of oil is probably, I don't remember exactly, but it was in the 50s, I think, throughout the bulk of the third quarter. It's in the 30s now, hit the 20s. Yeah. So I'm sure that had an impact on that producer.
And that would be, my point, that we have to be sure we are talking accurately and talk about the right time frame and looking at the right statistics as we make these analyses. It's just really important to say that an entity is making a profit today. I don't think that's an accurate statement, but I don't know until they report tomorrow.
And I would like to add, the administration does not want to eliminate the tax credit program. I think the conversation we're trying to have here before this committee and as the session progresses is, what is the appropriate level of support that we should continue to give to the industry, both the mature and the new coming industry, given our fiscal realities? You know, are there adjustments that deserve to be made based upon lessons learned in the last 10 years and the changes in the price of oil? And I would not want to characterize this as an upheaval or as an elimination of a program. It's an evolution of a program, if I may. So over the fall, really starting in after the last session, Senator Geisel put together a working group and several members of the other body, as well as some industry and local government input. They put together a very comprehensive report. It was impressive. I recommend you all read it. And in addition to highlighting the work done by the hearings, there were about 8-9 hearings, and the characterizing the needs of the various sectors, it came up with a series of recommendations. There are 6 of them. I just sort of put them up there to show how our bill is trying to meet, for the most part, the recommendations made by that committee.
Josephson's got a question.
Well, you were on a roll, but I'll go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Alper, through the chair, when I asked you about the limited repurchases on slide 14 and I mentioned local hire, you said there would be a $25 million limit, I think, per company. And then you talked about treating E&I and STAT and some of the big companies less like small domestic companies and more like what they are. But doesn't the bill also have some sort of pre-screening element to it that I've seen or heard of? And I'm just thinking that if there's going to be a discussion about the imposition of new revenue, and I could explain to a constituent that our geologists have looked at this and this thing is a great prospect, it's worth investing 35 cents in, that would be a wonderful conversation.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I recognize Representative Josephson sat in on several of the Senate working group meetings over the fall. And we did talk about in there the possibility of a pre-screening process. That did not survive to the final version of the bill. So there isn't sort of an application process. The earning of the credits remains open-ended. What you're referring to, and I don't like to name specific companies, and I'll get into it in a few slides, the provision is if right now the only restriction on getting cash from the state is do you produce 50,000 barrels or more in Alaska? Every other company, whether you're the world's fourth largest oil company to the mom and pop working out of their truck, can get cash for their credits. What we're saying is these larger companies with revenues in excess of $10 billion are going to earn credit certificates, but they're going to hold them and use them against future tax liability. The $25 million is the fork in that road, the alternative program put in place for the smaller companies who can cash in $25 million per year with the idea that if their projects are larger, they might take several years to work through their credits. As I get back to the slides before us, I just want to say I'm paraphrasing Senator Giesel. This is not a literal interpretation of what is in her report, and I look forward to talking to her more about it. But this is our sense of what was in the Giesel committee's in the Senate working group's final report that came out in early December. So gradual implementation, not forcing this on the industry too quickly. We are putting $1 billion in a transition fund for existing and future liability and not attempting to go backwards with these changes. Considering the sector impact.
We have a question from Representative Hopper.
And thank you. And right on that point one, and you've already tried to blunt my question here. I've got Senator Giesel's report in front of me, and I think I would take, you've been very selective about what you've chosen from it. You know, her report also says protect the stability of the Cook Inlet gas supply. Her report also says encourage North Slope production to come online will be critical for the fiscal health of the state. But to that word gradual implementation, the words in her report are a deliberate, methodical, and graduated approach that still honors commitments currently being made under existing law would be a reasoned strategy. A deliberate, methodical, and graduated approach, I don't think translates to a gradual implementation of your concepts here.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, PowerPoints are inherently a little bit compressed. There was no attempt to mischaracterize any point that was in there. The idea that I believe the senator made and her staff and her team and what we're trying to honor here is that we want to honor what has been earned to date, what is earned through the effective date of this bill, and make sure that people aren't, that we're not pulling the rug out from anybody who's mid-process. The rules are going to change at a future date after the end of this session, at which point the way and the rate and the rules under which we're paying people back will hopefully change. Likewise, in considering the impacts on different sectors, and these are numbered. There were six recommendations in the report, and we could certainly deconstruct what was actually said in the six recommendations. By maintaining future cash support for operating loss credits, we feel we're honoring that. All the different sectors of the economy benefit from that operating loss credit, and we want to make sure that the state doesn't completely back away from providing cash support for industry activities. Issue number three is not in the bill, but it is an important idea that came up. There have been a couple of high-profile bankruptcies. Unfortunately, there may be others. And if that occurs, oftentimes the secured lenders in the big banks and the East Coast tend to get paid before the local vendors providing local procurement, fuel, contracting work for these companies. We would like to find a mechanism to better protect our local folks. It is not in the bill. And we would love to try to find a mechanism to do that. It is important, and it's important, I know, to many of your constituents. Continuing on, the senator recommended protecting the minimum tax floor, specifically discussed operating loss credits, being able to penetrate that and reduce payments. We have a nearly precisely worded section in our bill that does exactly what that recommended, protecting that floor. We are also increasing the rate to 5%, which, granted, is not in the senator's recommendations. They talked about protecting the frontier basin tax breaks. The exploration tax credit for the interior parts of the state for the newly developing areas have already been extended in current law. They are not set to sunset until 2022. We intend to honor that and keep that going. What that means is exploration work in the developing areas of the state in the interior will continue to receive state support up to 65% of their costs. That's important. These are areas that have no current production, but we believe there's tremendous potential, and we want to continue on some of these projects that are in the very early stages of their development. Finally, how much information do we get? Reporting requirements. It is awkward, frankly, to sit before this committee and not be able to name names and talk about specific projects and specific dollar amounts. It would be easier to have these conversations if we could explain who's done what and how much money they've got. We don't want to talk about how much taxes someone pays or how much they're spending, how much money they make. But if someone's receiving state cash benefit, we feel just as we report how much we pay on chairs or people's salaries, we should be able to talk about specific companies and how much they earn in state refundable tax credits. So the next series of slides is a run through the specific features of the bill and the specific changes. I want to sort of pause and ask the chairman. I see it's almost 2:30. We are calendared to continue this presentation on Friday. I sort of assumed there'd be a lot of questions and that would extend into a second hearing. What would be an appropriate breaking point, or should we just go until the bell rings and we the clock runs out?
I think we'll go right until the clock runs out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Later in the presentation, we have a sectional analysis. There's also a printed sectional analysis on the table outside that goes through the bill in sequence order. Sometimes the linear read of any major piece of legislation gets a little awkward. It's a 46-section bill. There's a lot of conforming language and that sort of thing. These next few slides attempt to do a thematic analysis by type of issue and type of change that we make. After that, there's a series of slides that talk about how it will impact different sectors of the industry in different ways, but will be on the ground impact on different types of activity. So starting with the types of changes in the area of exploration credits, and I've mentioned already the jackup rig credits expire July of this year, as well as most of the what they call the 025 credits for the North Slope and for Cook Inlet. They have been extended for the Middle Earth area, the interior area, until 2022. The administration's policy is to do nothing, to let these things expire, to keep the Middle Earth credits and let the North Slope and Cook Inlet credits go away. There are also a couple of other older exploration credit bills, statutes on the books that have not been used in many years, out of some concern that they might be, frankly, resurrected with the loss of the alternative credit for exploration. We're looking to preemptively repeal them and just sort of close the door on that. You know, we don't want any sort of unforeseen credits that we aren't currently using to come up out of the woodwork. An interesting feature in our workings with, and the commissioner didn't mention, Department of Natural Resources has been involved in the development of this bill as well. They've made a lot of points, and they made several presentations to Senator Giesel's committee over the fall. One of their concerns is the loss of information. They get, through the exploration credit program, a lot of specific data, seismic data, downhole data. Some of that they're able to use for their own planning and strategizing and deciding what areas to lease in the future. Some of that data becomes public and can be used by other companies after a certain number of years. We would like to sort of respect and protect that benefit and attach those DNR data reporting requirements to some of the surviving credits that are going to remain on the books. And I mentioned the 023B, that's the net operating loss credit, really the largest credit that will remain after the change. We want to make sure that that DNR continues to receive meaningful data for ongoing activity in Alaska. The next one, and this might be the most controversial, this repeals the 023A and L. That's the qualified capital expenditure and the well lease expenditure credit for Cook Inlet. Now, those are the credits that are typically stacked with an operating loss credit, which leads to the very large numbers, the 50-60% state support of the spending-based credits. Senate Bill 21 repealed the comparable credits on the North Slope, so in some ways we're extending SB 21 tax treatment to other areas of the state. Another interesting feature of current law, and it's awkward to talk about, but because we have these spending-based credits commingled with a tax cap for the hard maximum tax, you have circumstances where a profitable company producing oil and gas in Cook Inlet could be paying zero taxes but still receiving relatively large state tax credit payments based upon their activity drilling wells, what effectively becomes a large negative tax. By repealing these credits, we would be eliminating that and saying, you know, through 2022, you'll continue to get zero, you know, pay zero, but we're not paying you credits if you're not paying taxes. There is an understanding that before the Cook Inlet tax caps repeal in 2022, the legislature is going to need to address the underlying Cook Inlet tax regime. It's something of a hybrid. It draws together pieces of ACES and SB 21. It's probably not stable, but it doesn't matter for the next 5 or 6 years because of the existence of those tax caps.
To this point.
Representative Huck.
And thank you. And I appreciate you mentioning that, too, because you know, I'm the father of those tax credits, and I would simply offer, too, that we've stopped in South Central Alaska having brownout and blackout drills because we were successful in achieving what we wanted to accomplish. I think we all, this committee sat here and just said, you know, we see we've accomplished something good. And there is always that need for a feedback loop to evaluate it. And that's why we put into Senate 138 last year, a requirement that I believe it's January 1st something 2017, there will be a complete review, a comprehensive review performed of these, the Cook Inlet Basin tax system. So we had a, again, deliberate and rational and well-explained and analyzed basis for making changes. You know, we're here, you know, you're straight out saying, we're going to repeal them, we're going to repeal them this year. What is the consequence on my community? You know, you live in Juneau, you don't care. I care about my community. And I apologize, you probably do care, but I care about my community. I had a community that was practicing for blackout drills. What do we do when there are no heat and no lights in my town in the middle of winter? Here we're just going to repeal what solved that problem. What analysis, what support, what evaluation have you done to show that repealing these will not hurt my community?
It's good to kick the hard ones up to the boss.
Through the chair, Representative Hocker. In our discussions with industry right now, there really is a dynamic within Cook Inlet of gas looking for a market. The work that was done was successful, and so I think it begs the question that, you know, how, you know, do we need to maintain this level of credits at this point in time in the life of those fields? We accomplished what you set out to accomplish. There is gas. There's a reliable supply of gas in Cook Inlet right now. That will last for a while. 4 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years from now, would there may be a need to re-incentivize? That may be the case. But the question is, in a time where, and with quite frankly, the budget restrictions that we have right now, is it prudent to maintain those credits when we do have a gas supply available right now?
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner, that's exactly you're answering my question with a question. You're asking, with all respect, I am asking, what have you done specifically? You know, again, we the legislature saw this coming. We agree with you. It's a time to, you know, we got to reevaluate this. Your agency, you know, previous administration, asked that they got until January 1st of 2017 to do a true evaluation and analysis, so we were making fact-based decisions. You know, anecdotally, when you talk with industry, yeah, look at all that. We got gas out there. And again, I point you at February 1st, Alaska Public Media, one of the major players down there who has gas to bring on, the Cosmopolitan Development, says they're just not going to do it if they're likely not. They probably won't develop the natural gas in Cosmo if the legislature makes big changes to the tax credit program. Who else is not going to develop? What is Hillcorp going to do? What is going to be a, you know, what can Hillcorp continue to do? Do we throw ourselves back into cardiac arrest? And again, what have we done? What have you done to evaluate this question?
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, this kind of runs into that kind of wall about who I can talk about specifically. But I can tell you that we are still in ongoing conversations with these companies about what it's going to take to get them to the finish line.
But you'd like us to pass this bill and pull the rug out from under them before they get to the finish line?
Through the chair, I expect that they will come. They will provide you with information, and we can engage in a further conversation as that information is provided.
We've got 80 more days,
Representative Hocker. The field in question is several years worth of gas supply for Cook Inlet, potentially, that has been discovered, that is known, that should we find ourselves in a crisis situation years down the road, it's not as terrifying to bring that on because we know that it's there. You know, the provisions and the benefits in the bill that you carried 5 years ago have done great things towards giving supply certainty to your constituents, no question. And that is, that supply is known, and now it's just a matter of getting it what they call behind pipe, getting the wells drilled, which is a lot different than going out and finding it.
Well, I think I'd offer every petroleum engineer I know says nothing actually counts until it's on the surface and pumping. As you start trying to develop it, you can discover all kinds of challenges and complications in getting it out of the ground. I mean, take a look at the prospectivity that, you know, people have talked about up at Badami. Sitting there, it has some of the greatest potential in the state, and it's one of the hardest things that's been to develop. I mean, it's just like you just don't get anything out of the structure. even though the petroleum geologist has said, my point being, I am really not willing to risk my community's energy security on your comments here of just, you know, trust us, we're going to get there. And I don't like the idea of pulling the rug out from under them now. But give me, I'm only asking that you give me a competent, quality analysis that shows that we retain our security. And I'd like to see more than just the trust me in this bill.
Yep, and through the chair, Representative Hocker, some of that we just simply can't provide the committee.
I understand.
Representative Josephson.
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alper answered the question.
Okay. I'm Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I just wouldn't otherwise comment, but I do feel a little bit uncomfortable with the idea that, you know, my responsibility is to a company rather than to the people that I represent. And I guess I just feel like, based on some of the comments that have been made, I need to say that on the record, that I hope those individuals will come before the committee and testify, and we'll get the full picture of their development plans and you know, get their reaction to how things, you know, may impact that or change or alter things going forward. But I don't feel like that's my responsibility, and my responsibility is to the people that I represent, and there are many needs going forward, and we have to balance all of those needs. So thank you.
Representative Tarr. Keaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And since we were talking about these Cook Inlet drilling credits, you know, the one field, one of the fields that we're talking about is in my district. However, you know, if we were talking about subsidizing a operation having to take money out of the state coffers at this time to do something which there's no market for unless it's exported, that may be a value to a company to export gas, but for us to subsidize an operation at this point in time for an export market seems to be something that we need to consider. You know, that's another part of this mixture of things of what we can afford to subsidize, give credits for when there's no taxes being paid on that for an export market. So anyway, I'm interested in listening to all the arguments on this side, but I wanted to also put on the marketability of that gas. Thank you.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to follow up what Representative Seaton just said, the credits in question in Cook Inlet were, of course, intended for issues of gas security, but they were not limited to just gas development and exploration work. A lot of that money has been spent on companies that were looking for and increasing the oil production from Cook Inlet, which is great. There's no problem with more oil. It's jobs, it's revenue, it's export. But it's not quite the matter of life and death to the people of South Central as gas supply issues are. You know, a large amount of these Cook Inlet credits have, frankly, been spent on oil development projects. Moving on to the next slide, the repurchase limits. I mentioned some of this before in my response to Representative Josephson's question. The current restriction says companies with more than 50,000 barrels a day must hold their certificates until they have future production. We are expanding those limitations to say the global annual revenue greater than $10 billion per year. You hold your, you know, colloquially we say if you're bigger than us, if you as an economy are larger than the state of Alaska, then you probably don't need our cash money. You can your own balance sheet can support this project. The PPT era cap back in 2006 and 7, the limit for repurchase was $25 million per company per year. We're reinstituting that. We're also putting in an Alaska higher provision that the governor himself came up with. The idea is if you have say $10 million in credit repurchase coming to you, but you have 70% Alaska higher, we'll give you the $7 million, 70% of your credit. Based on your Alaska higher percentage and the rest of it, you can carry forward until you have tax liability.
Representative Herron?
On that, this section here, this new limitation, and I appreciate what your explanation is, but where else is it done in the world?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I'm not so sure there's that many places in the world where they're giving refundable cash credits for oil and gas development, so it's a fairly narrow universe to compare to. So I don't have an answer to that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Harper.
I'll ask a question. What is the purpose of a government's tax revenue system? What's the purpose of it?
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, to collect taxes for revenue for state operations.
Is the purpose of the tax system to enact social policy?
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, in my opinion, no.
Thank you.
Continue.
Certainly. And the last change being made in the repurchase limit sort of sections of the bill is this idea that you have 10 years to use them. If you don't come into production and have a meaningful tax liability within 10 years, those credits will start to expire. So a couple of sort of smaller but provisions that came to our attention as we started processing credits over the last year or so, calling them loopholes, there are a couple of features in existing law that can inflate a net operating loss credit to larger than what it might be intended to be. For example, if you have an operating loss and you're a new producer eligible for the GVR, we found circumstances where the companies are able to use the gross value reduction as a subtraction mechanism from your taxable profits intended to reduce taxes. But if you're at a loss, companies are able to use that GVR to increase the size of their operating loss on paper. And then the operating loss credit is tied to that adjusted number, and we've led to situations where we're literally paying companies more than 100% of their loss through refundable credits. That surprised us, but we took it through the legal system and found that, no, in fact, that is a literal interpretation of what the statute says, and we hope to fix that. Another one of these has to do with a municipal utility. If a utility owns gas production, say, and is burning it themselves in their own turbines and supplying their own customers, their own citizens, that's fine. That's not really a taxable event. But what happens if they have a little bit of surplus production and they sell it to a third party, let's just say? Well, again, a literal interpretation of the law says they can take that tiny amount of revenue that comes from selling 1 or 2% of their production and offset all of their expenses against it for the purposes of calculating certain credits and certain benefits. And that's one of those things that the lawyers say, nope, that's what it says. And we say, well, I don't think that's what it's supposed to say, so we're going to try to clean that up in one of the sort of secondary features of the legislation.
Thank you. Can you explain the gross revenue reduction, GVR? Sometimes we're calling it a credit, or it becomes a credit. Seems to be a credit, but we don't want to call it a credit in most circumstances. Is it really just a credit and being applied in different ways?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I don't consider the gross value reduction a credit per se, because it's a subtraction from taxable value. It's an awkward calculation, and let me try to back up to 2013 and the way it was presented to this committee and others during the hearings on Senate Bill 21. And back then we were assuming a price of oil of around $100 a barrel, so we were going to have to fantasize a little bit to get there. But presuming that $100 oil and that the oil in question results in roughly $50 a barrel in taxable profits. And then they're saying, well, if it's new oil, if it meets the criteria that we want to give a benefit for new oil to, we're going to come up with a mechanism to say, we're going to turn that 50 into 30, and for the purposes of the tax system, we're only going to tax $30 of that profit, and therefore effectively collect less taxes. What happens if that company is suddenly losing money? If they are either because they're drilling new wells and they're building out and they're spending more than they're earning, or simply because the price of oil has collapsed and they don't have profits anymore, and now they're losing $10. Well, under normal circumstances, that $10 loss would result in an operating loss credit. Last year it was 45%, so we would be paying that company $4.50 for every barrel produced in which they had a $10 loss. But because of the implementation of this gross value reduction, that negative 10 turns into a negative 30 on paper. They get to subtract the what should be a profit reducer for tax purposes to become a loss increaser. And now based on a $30 loss, 45% of that is $13.50. And we're now paying that company $13.50 a barrel on that barrel that they actually lost $10 producing. So that's I don't know if that answers your question, but no, we don't consider it a credit, but it's a value offset, I guess, is the term for it.
Go ahead.
Would there be any distinction if it was said we're going to give you a 20% credit on the value of the oil produced?
During the hearings, not just on Senate Bill 21 through the chair, Representative Seaton, but in the several years before that were different variations of oil tax reform bills were working their way through the legislature. There was an attempt to find a mechanism to give benefits to new oil. And it's a technically complicated conversation because expenditures tend to be commingled, and there's a sort of decoupling issues, and you know, so tying it to a percentage of gross value was sort of the cleanest mathematical means of doing it. I suppose it could be a credit, but the credit would have to be tied to the gross value of the production, not the net, because once again, it's hard to separate out net value from field to field. There's different ways to do it. You know, the governor supports the existence of a specific benefit for new oil. If the committee wished to try to readdress that and find a different way to do it, I'd be happy to help put together some ideas.
It seems like, you know, we're talking about all these things with different terms, but it seems like it's a 20% credit on the gross value of the oil. And it's applied as a credit. I mean, you take it off for the calculations or anything else. And unless I'm misunderstanding that, it seems like we throw a lot of terminology at the public, and if it's not applied differently, or maybe I'm misunderstanding it. And that's what I'm trying to do, is find out why this isn't just considered a 20% credit on the gross value.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, and perhaps if in a loss situation, in many ways it could be, in a situation where the producer in question is profitable, then how do you characterize it as a credit? You know, by subtracting a percentage of gross value from a net profit number, there's a multiplier in place that it depends on the ratio of their costs to the value of the oil. Colloquially, we say a 20% gross value reduction is roughly equivalent to a 40% reduction in net value. That's not actually true today. That was true a few years ago when prices were higher. But you know, it was intended to, round numbers, cut the company's taxes in half. In today's world, it's greater than that because the new oil is able to pay at the zero level and the old oil is paying at the minimum tax level. So it's an infinite cut of their taxes. That's all of their taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So stepping away from the credit provisions for a minute into the minimum tax or the floor, what we're trying to do with this bill is say you actually have to pay the minimum tax, which is the current statute 4% at current prices. So you can't use an operating loss credit or a small producer credit or an exploration credit to offset the minimum tax. The minimum tax is a minimum, and if you have credits that you've earned in excess of that and they could be carried forward, you would carry them into the next year. You know, this is, you know, the next point is awkward. You know, it's very hard to say without violating confidentiality, but, you know, we can show, and we gave out our credit estimate report. It's a two-page report from the revenue sources book that we shrunk down and we put on the table outside. One or more of the major producers will show a net operating loss in 2015. Now, what does that mean? In the way the law is written, that company or companies will be able to turn their loss into a 45% operating loss credit, and beginning in January, use that credit to offset their minimum tax payments all the way down to zero until such time, presuming prices stay low in 2016, that they're able to work through their operating loss credit and use it all up. You'll see that on the credit forecast as a North Slope credits used against tax liability in the 023 category. And, you know, we feel that the major producers should be paying at the minimum tax, that's what the minimum tax is for. And by implementing this, we're going to say, no, in fact, the 4% is true, and you would carry it forward into the next year when there are higher profits and therefore higher tax liability, and you could use it. And I want to put up front, this is the one provision of the bill that we are requesting to be made retroactive to January 1st of this year because of the specific situation I just outlined. The other expansion of the floor is to so-called new oil. This follows up on the conversation we just had over Representative Seaton's question. The new oil, the gross value reduction eligible oil, can go to zero. We want to make that oil pay at the 4% level as well. In a more subtle point, the third bullet there, the per taxable barrel credits can sort of migrate from month to month under current law. That there are months in which they get cut off and are unused because the minimum tax gets in the way. They can only subtract so much. What we found specifically in calendar year 2014, where there was a lot of volatility, the price of oil was over 100 in January and down into much lower numbers at the end of the year. Companies were able to move their per barrel credits around when the true up happened at the end of the year. And effectively, we wrote large refunds to certain companies at the end of calendar year 2014 that were not expected. The bill makes a change that turns the per taxable barrel credit into more of a true monthly calculation. And finally, which is the part that's been the most widely discussed because it's frankly the easiest part to understand, we are looking to increase the minimum tax rate itself from 4% to 5%.
Mr. Chairman.
Yep, Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Alper, so on the per taxable barrel credit, where you called it sort of a migrating thing, does that mean that, in effect, it could be carried forward to a different month but within the same year, and the industry could wait for a more profitable month? Is that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it's hard to explain precisely without a blackboard and a lawyer, but the production tax is an annual tax, not a monthly tax. There's a very long and precise and convoluted section of law that talks about how you make monthly estimated tax payments. And then there's what you call true-up, where you pay your taxes at the end of the year and you commingle it all. And it's not so much carrying it forward is that when you do the combined calculation as opposed to the 12 separate calculations, you end up being able to use more of those per-barrel credits that you weren't able to use on a month-by-month basis.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Representative
Hoffman. Could you be very clear what you're talking about when you're talking about per taxable barrel credits?
Per taxable barrel credit, through the chair, Representative Hawker, is the what Representative Hawker, what you said earlier in the presentation was not really a credit but an offset, but a component of the tax. This is the subtraction mechanism in SB 21 for North Slope production that says here's this 35% tax, and then you get a reduction in that tax of between $0 and $8 per barrel, which is tied to the price of oil. That per barrel credit is based on the price of oil in that month, so that it varies from month to month. However, in those months where it might be at the highest level, $8 a barrel, those are the months when the prices are very low. And if the prices are low enough, the companies don't get to use the full $8 because the minimum tax payment gets in the way. They can only use them until it gets cut off and essentially foregone at the minimum tax. What happens, though, at annual true-up, if there's volatility and higher value in earlier months, the foregone credits from one month could be used to offset taxes effectively from another month.
And you hit exactly my point here, and thank you for clarifying that these per taxable barrel credits are really the GVR, the gross value reduction that we're talking about here.
Through the chair, no, Mr. No, Representative Hawker.
No.
The GVR is the new oil specific subtraction mechanism to reduce the production tax value for what's called new oil fields that they pay the 35% on a smaller number. The per barrel credit is calculated after the 35% tax and it's subtracted from tax liability. It's the production based tax.
Okay. And to that, I appreciate the clarity, but you know, this is one where we had days of testimony in this committee on this exact issue. Mm-hmm. And it was a policy call of this committee and the legislature that we did want to average these things because we showed some really, like I say, when you try to isolate them on a monthly basis, you do get anomalous results that are really not intended in that we want to look at business on its annual cycle rather than saying, okay, this month you made a bunch of money, we're going to take every bit of it. Next month you get a loss, we're not going to give you much of value for that, and we're going to effectively increase our government take by taxing you on these spikes. And I just want to tell you, it was a policy call of this committee and the legislature not to do that. So, again, you're asking us to take a complete reversal in policy direction here.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, two observations. The first is when the tax reform effort of 2013 took place, the conversation before this in every committee were, on a range of oil prices between $80 and roughly $120. I don't personally believe that adequate consideration was given to what happens outside that range, and we're finding realities that were unanticipated. We did not know what would happen. Technical features of the law that are acting in unpredictable and unknown ways, and we're trying to react to those. Secondly, I would say, when we got to the end of 2014, We thought the taxes were collected. We projected at the time about $525 million in production tax revenue, a combination of a few months of high prices and a few months of low prices. We were frankly surprised at when the tax returns came in at the end of March to learn that we owed close to $150 million in refunds based on the feature that we're talking about in this provision right here, the ability to move some credits around within the year. And in a time of great fiscal shortfall, that was $150 million that we didn't think we wanted to spend, but we had to per the law the way it was written.
I agree. You're looking to make a new policy call here. It's just going to take some selling to convince us that the decisions we made, at least to me, the decisions we made previously, which I will disagree with you, that I do believe we did an adequate diligence in our process in this committee and in the legislature. And that's dialogue we can have elsewhere. But and if that is your allegation that we had an inadequate process here, I think we need to have a conversation in the public about that.
Thank you,
sir. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Other provisions, sort of the smaller provisions of the bill, but they are by no means not material. Interest rate reform. There was an unusual feature. All versions of Senate Bill 21 had an interest rate reform section that got sort of a late technical amendment in the final committee that led to the scenario where, whereas all previous versions had compound interest, we now only collect simple interest on underpayments and assessments, essentially, when we come back in an audit and say you owe more money. So first off, that's a technical correction that needs to be made. We believe it was the intent of the body to have compound interest because every version of the bill had it. The late technical amendment in House Finance that changed it didn't discuss that change, so we're just trying to clean that up. More importantly and more material, we're looking to increase the interest rate. Right now, the interest rate on underpaid taxes is 3% above the federal discount rate. This quarter, it's 4%. It was 11%, and under previous law, that was most likely too high. The thinking we have inside the administration is, presuming that we are soon or eventually going to be, in one way or another, spending the state's savings, spending earnings from the permanent fund, partially to help fund government, every dollar that we don't get in taxes because someone didn't pay them is a dollar we have to take out of savings. And when we finally do get paid, because we've audited that taxpayer, we want to be paid back for our opportunity cost, for what we would have earned on that dollar had it stayed in savings over the intervening years. So we want the interest rate for tax delinquency tied roughly to the expected rate of return for the permanent fund, which is around 7%. The second major change is the confidentiality waiver. I mentioned that a little bit earlier. We just want to name the companies and how much they've received in state repurchased credits. Fairly straightforward. Another technical change, suddenly in an era of very low prices, we are seeing, especially in those more remote fields that have higher tariffs, we have transportation costs that in a moment in time might exceed the market value. We could have gross value of the point of production of less than zero. That's unprecedented circumstance. We don't know how that will be implemented. So we just want to clean that up and want to specify in the gross value of the point of production statutes that it can't be brought below zero. And finally, right now, if you have earned a credit and you owe the state taxes, any state tax, it could be a fish tax or a tobacco tax, we could offset that tax against your credit. However, if you have other obligations to the state, for example, a royalty or a lease payment or some other judgment, we can't necessarily do that. We want to loosen that up and say before we give you cash for your credits, we want to offset any obligation that you might have to the state. And that's a technical change that's made, and there's a bunch of conforming language throughout the bill that makes that change. The next part of the bill, we start talking about specific sector impacts, and I'm going to give another pause and offer the chairman the opportunity to end here and go to questions and move the rest of it to the next hearing, or we can keep going.
I'd like to, we're getting close to 3 o'clock, so I'm going to travel out for the rest of the day, and then we'll come back Friday, and you can start again right here. And I want to thank all of you for this presentation, and also the give and take we've had here. And I think we all are seeing that we have to be deliberate and ask questions, and then make sure that we're clear as to what we're going to do after we have this presentation, because we have a lot of work, I think, ahead of us. We have all these challenges, but we need to understand that we both need to work together and also with the industry and others to make sure that we our future is clear as to what we will do in times like this. We're in a very harsh time in terms of the finance and the price of the commodity and everything else. So we need to do this deliberately, and we hope that we will come up with something that will work for us. Thank you very much, and we will gavel up at 2:56.